Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Sorceress Commentary from New World Pictures Podcast. And this is the end of our Corman Graduates Jack Hill series and the final movie that he made for New World Pictures and the final movie he made in general. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
I think there is a sorceress in this movie.
We're going to find it tonight. And Erica.
I go by Bruno Ray now. Or Anna de... Nope, just call me Bruno Ray. Just call me Bruno Ray.
Well, Bruno, let's get into it. Now, in this movie, we're gonna hear a lot of unsatisfactory things from Jack Hill, because this is a movie that he produced. He is in the credits as producing something that Corman threw in there that he was unaware of until he saw the movie, and he did change his name to Brian Stewart, but he is the director of this film. And now, where we left off with Jack Hill in our series was in 1975 Switchblade Sisters, which was sadly unsuccessful at the box office. Jack did not direct a film between Switchblade Sisters and this, though he definitely tried to. Despite Jack's other successes at the box office with Coffee and The Swinging Cheerleaders, Jack struggled to get a directing job. So he went back to Corman and New World, and he actually wrote 1978's The Bees, which we covered on this podcast.
Yep.
And Jack was supposed to actually direct that film, but he even cast it, and he went down to Mexico to start shooting it. And on day one, he was replaced by the Mexican producer, Alfredo Zacarias, apparently due to union laws. So
right here in this scene, I think it's interesting. They've been camping out, and Trigon, it just finds them camping, and they say, well, the House of Krona isn't far away. We can try to stall them, and you can run over there. Which begs the question, why didn't they just hide out at the House of Krona to begin with? Why just be walking distance away and in the open?
A lot of people make some bad decisions in this movie. It's a series of really logic-less decisions made here.
Spoiler alert, fair. If anybody started with the commentary.
Some people do that.
Yeah, they start with the commentary.
Yeah, I want to learn. And then I'll watch the actual movie.
Then watch the movie, right. Go in more informed. That's the right way to do it.
With Jack not being able to direct The Bees, he would write two scripts for Sandy Howard, the first of which was another disaster film, 1979's City on Fire, but Canadian tax shelter laws kept him from directing the project, so Alvin Rakoff directed the movie instead, and Jack's script was rewritten by Canadian writers, though he is still credited. Next up for him was 1980's Death Ship, a project Sandy Howard gave to Jack that he completely reworked, but again was rewritten once the project was set up to film in Canada, again with Alvin Rakoff directing. Neither movie was a success, so once again he'll return to New World to direct this, a project he took because Corman's special effects studios that Corman was doing at the lumber yard. And as he told, Jack Hill told Cine Schlockerama in 2002, he said, Roger said he wanted to make a sword and sorcery movie. He had the special effects house that he owned that was doing really good work. And he wanted to do a really big looking movie, so I went for it. That's what I needed. A movie that looked big and flashy to get me out of the category of shoestring budget movies. He was looking at this as his comeback movie. This movie, which is obviously a... Conan the Barbarian riff in that world.
riffing
on some Conan. The movie ended up being,
and then Jesus appeared.
There he is.
Dope necklace, Jesus.
he went from far away is Jesus, up close he looks like he's been vacationing in Hawaii and just got back from a trip to Hilo Hatties.
Just looking real sweet in a sweet new Hawaiian shirt.
Got those puka shells going.
This movie was a co-production between Corman, the Mexican Government Film Commission, Conacyn, who brought us Foxtrot, which was released by New World Pictures, amongst other films, and also Hemdale, who was going to get the UK rights, and we'll get more about them a little bit later. According to Jack, Conacine put up $250,000 for this movie.
Dude looks really good in red.
He does.
Know what I mean?
He does look good.
Looks really good in it. Like, I know he's supposed to look like evil and villainous, but I don't know. It's kind of his color. Look at him. Just slaying in red.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh!
It goes definitely a summer.
Lighting eyes. With those eyes. Lighting eyes. He's not good. He's evil. Oh! Red and green. Watch out.
By the way, playing Jesus here, this is actually, or Corona as he's called in the film, is actually Martin LaSalle. He's a French actor who moved to Uruguay as a child with his family during World War II, went back to France where he began his career as an actor in Robert Bresson's 1959 film Pickpocket, then eventually emigrated to Mexico where he became a citizen and he appeared in a small role in The Bees, and then eventually 1984's Toy Soldiers, which was also released by New World Pictures. And an episode of Crime Story. So he's in a lot of New World stuff. By the way, so what I was saying, Conacine was putting up $250,000. Roger was going to put up $250,000. But Jack says that Corman charged $500,000 against the budget to Callum Waddle. So got a little bit of money off the top there. So.
So here you have, Krona is learning about the girl children and that he's taking his vow that he will raise them and teach them to be ultimate warriors, which is a noble thing to do, for sure.
You know, when this is one of our earliest episodes of this podcast, we talked about this movie, mm-hmm. and I, rewatching this, I was like, oh man, girl children should be a drinking game. Every time they say girl children, but actually it's not said as much as I remember it.
Put your blue hands on these babies, cover them with magic. Cover them up with
blue magic.
The two that are one would probably get you a little more wasted.
Yeah, yeah, you'll get nice and drunk if you do that. But yeah, girl children, I really thought that was going to be the drinking game, but unfortunately it is not.
And here we are introduced to, is it Dargon?
Tragon, you mean?
Is the
Tragon's in red? In red, yeah.
This guy, Dargon. There's a lot of Ogons in this movie.
Yes.
And this is one of them. Because Krona has decided within an hour of babysitting these children, actually, he wants nothing to do with them.
I'm not going to be a good dad, guys.
At a neighbor's house.
I know this about myself.
Yeah.
I know I made a promise before the mom died, but I cannot handle these children. Can you take these?
Yeah, I put my blue magic hands on them.
What's crazy is that do a walkabout.
The wife, so here, the wife takes the two girls, and she is already nursing their own daughter. And she's like, I've got enough milk for all three. And I'm like, that's weird. I'm not sure that's not how the body works exactly, but.
I don't know. I think it's pretty dope. It's a real flex. You know what I mean? She's like, I can nurse as many babies as I want. Fuck it.
That baby's not drinking, though, right? Like, that baby was not drinking. That baby was not on her boob, which is probably a good thing.
That baby wasn't drinking, Ryan. It was nursing. God, do you even have any kids? Jeez.
Let's talk a little bit about the script. The script for this movie is credited to Jim Wynorski. According to him, he was instructed to write this movie by Roger Corman, who was looking to capitalize on the success of Conan the Barbarian. Wynorski told Maitland McDonough in 1989 that he said, quote, I came in on Monday with a 77-page script that I figured would be added to, knocked around a little bit, rewritten, the usual. Roger took it into his office, came out an hour and a half later, and said, we were going to make it, and I should start casting right away. I said, but Roger, and then this is exactly how Jack recalls the script. It's not the same. In fact, it's quite different. He told Callum, quote, Jim had nothing whatever to do with the story or the script, and I consider his taking screen credit for it an utterly shameless violation of filmmaking ethics. So, look, I buy Corman putting Jim up to writing a first draft. I also see Corman handing that draft over to Jack Hill and Jack Hill saying, I'm going to completely rewrite this. I'm not going to just keep it the same. I see all that being so when he, true, but...
When Trigon dies, he says that once the moon is in the House of the Dragon once more, he will return. And that light behind him indicates that the moon is near the House of the Dragon. And really, it's just kind of on a part of the round thing behind him. It, like, this is where Raiders of the Lost Ark got it right, with the Staff of Ra.
Yeah.
And actually having it point to something of significance. Because this, it's just light on a thing?
This is, yeah, Spielberg said this was his inspiration to get that right. He was like, Sorceress failed. And I'm gonna do what Sorceress could not.
Well, the moon in the House of the Dragon is talked about in reference to dragons in Game of Thrones. Are you saying also that George Martin watched this movie and went, that's an idea I can work with.
Yep. Yeah. One of his drunken sailings. Here we are with the twins here. Yeah, but
don't worry. I don't worry all about that, Mark. Now let's take a swim. Let's just jump into Dig's little swim with the twins. Just don't worry about how we came to come back. And here we are in the full moon. It's just nude swim time. Here we go.
As you do with your twin, you'd normally just take a naked swim. Lee and Lynette Harris are playing our twins. They had been featured in Playboy in 1981. Jack says they were recommended to him after appearing in the film Eye of the Jury, which Larry Cohen wrote and started directing before he was fired after his first week. Jack says to Callum, I quote, I got a recommendation on them that they had been very professional and done a very good job, but little did I know that they had silicone tits. Well, one of them lost a lot of weight after getting sick, except for on her chest. But luckily, we got a woman who could stunt double for them and looked exactly like them from the back and had the same kind of build. So, hooray!
But more importantly, in this scene, we're introduced to, I think, everyone's Pando. Favorite character.
Pando. Played by David Milburn, who had appeared in Slumber Party Massacre before this. He's one of the two guys that hangs out at the side of the house. And this is supposed to be played by Sid Haig, but according to what Jack told Callum, said Corman would not pay Haig's rate for the film, nor would he get other cast members. In fact, he was supposed to fill this film with a cast of name actors, and he didn't do that. And he wouldn't pay for Sid either.
If Sid was going to play this role anywhere close to the way it's played in this movie, I would have been very sad for Sid.
I think Sid is not too bummed he wasn't in this movie. I think Jack is bummed that Sid wasn't in this movie. I don't think the reverse is true.
That's fair.
To get back to the controversy about who, about the writing of this, here's how I think this sequence went. I think that, like I was saying, I think that Wynorski handed his script over to Corman and then Jack rewrote it. I think that's how it went. And I know this because in my hands is the New World and 1982 flyer that they send out about their upcoming releases. And Sorceress is in there, and what they list in there is not the exact same movie. In fact, they describe it like this. Traveling amid these primitive environs are Radha and Rami, a pair of sensuous twins on a quest of ultimate revenge. Seeking out the nefarious magician who viciously murdered their parents, both lovely women are keenly aware that their journey will take them directly through the dreaded Forbidden Zone, from which no mortal has ever returned. Enlisting the aid of a handsome barbarian mercenary, they set off on an amazing foray into the bizarre, the violent, and the untamed. Their goal can only be reached by enduring the challenges of Poldar, seven nightmarish pitfalls that only Herculean strength and sharpened wits can defeat. Certainly there's a revenge story. We're seeing that right here, where some of Trigon's men are searching for the two that are one and are burning down this village and trying to find these two kids. But the rest of that is not the same. In fact, Mira and Mara are the name of the twins in here, not Radha and Rami. The Forbidden Zone does not exist. The Poldar pitfalls, those are not there. Well, so
you have the catacombs.
I don't want to interrupt, but like the dad's kind of hot, right? Maybe you guys can't weigh in on this, but I don't know. Like, I don't know if it's that tattered shirt or if it's the gray in the beard, but I don't know. Dad's kind of got it going on.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just saying, just take him, you know, take him captive. You don't have to slay him. Just
He's
take him captive.
Got a real Michael McDonald look to him for sure.
Yeah. Is that it? Yeah, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that is it. Yeah.
Okay. Glad we...
By the way, this is also not... Glad we settled that, yes. This is not Corman's first attempt to make a sword and sorcery movie. New World was initially going to release Hawk the Slayer in 1980. They even put out a press in their 1980 guide. They actually listed the movie as one of theirs, along with The Prize Fighter and other films that they actually did release. Hawk the Slayer was amongst them, but they didn't release it. They actually ended up losing the rights.
Ugh, and so many arrows into Hot Dad right after he wielded his nunchucks. Are they nunchucks or nunchucks?
Nunchucks, I believe. But that is nunchucks. A wild inclusion that he would suddenly have nunchucks. That's pretty cool, actually.
No more wild than the bird outfits that all the warriors wear.
Yeah.
Why are they in bird outfits?
That's got to be your favorite thing, Erica,
because,
that he has
I love
bird
it.
Masks.
Because everybody's afraid of birds, so it just adds another layer of fear. Blue
By
power,
the way, the music
blue
they play...
Power.
The music they play during this, if you've seen Battle Beyond the Stars, you recognize most of the music in this because it's a recycled score. He uses scores from a bunch of other movies, but a lot of Battle Beyond the Stars, which he did in tons of movies.
If you saw Battle Beyond the Stars and Space Raiders, you'll think, or if you saw Space Raiders and not Battle Beyond the Stars, you might think, he stole some stuff from Space Raiders.
Right. You don't know. It all went down to Battle Beyond the Stars, but it's sometimes hard to figure out where did all the stuff he stole come from? This was also
that
a point
arrow
of contention for Jack Hill.
When she catches that arrow and fires it back at him. Oh, yes. And?
Here she goes with
got him.
Did she get
got
him? You bet she
Be
did.
Be free, little horse.
Yeah.
Got him.
Horse is like, see you guys.
Now, they also said that this was, Trigon doesn't come back for like, what, 25 years? So these girls are...
It was 20 years.
Okay.
But here, these, Pando and...
Baldar
have just been hanging out behind those rocks watching the whole time.
Right.
They were like, I don't want to get into this one.
Conscientious objectors here. We did not want to. We did not want to get involved.
It's not that we're against fighting. We just weren't really sure.
I have a sword and a shield. I'm ready to fight at any time. My sword is in my hand, but I didn't want to get involved here. This was... That is actually Bruno Ray.
Just going into...
Bruno Ray plays Baldar there. I'm sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
Panda was just getting into the third verse of this great pan flute song that he's got going on, and I couldn't interrupt him.
He has a gift. I can't interrupt that.
Most of the people that are in this movie are Mexican actors, with the exception of the Harris twins and the guy playing Pando. How weird is it? And then, like... He's in the makeup like half
Moses.
The day. Yeah. I was Jesus before, now I am Gandalf. And he's gonna do some serious Gandalfing here, like I said earlier, because
he pops
up in the story when he's needed, and then he like disappears when he also just like, cool, you got a lot you guys need to do, but I'm gonna head out. So good luck with that whole thing you guys need to do, but I'm out. I'm just gonna set you guys in motion.
Yeah.
20 years, though, they make them about, 20 years old here, but they have been taught nothing by their parents. Not only the fact that they are women and not boys, but they are so naive in this movie.
But when they talk about, they mention them being great fighters. When Gandalf walks up and he says, I'm the one that taught them to fight. No. You dropped them off an hour after you were supposed to take care of them. and left. Right. They were went on a walkabout.
They were babies.
You just showed up 20 years later.
It was like
later.
3 minutes ago, dude. We didn't forget. You were immediately like, hey, these two babies, you want to raise them, right? I got to head out and I got wizard stuff. Lots of wizard stuff I got to do. These babies.
He's like the deadbeat dad that suddenly discovered his two kids are successful. And he's like, oh, I knew you would always be successful.
Oh, from the beginning, I knew how terrific you two would be. Like I said, this is shot in Mexico, but originally Jack says that Corman wanted to shoot this in the Philippines, which is a locale that Jack would be very familiar with, having done his Women in Prison films there. But he actually balked at that because he had set the story in Central Asia. And he was like, the Philippines isn't going to look like Central Asia. And he would just continue to have a lot of other... I don't think Mexico does either. Here's where Gandalf's into this fire and just disappears for the film. Good job. Thanks for being here, Krona.
but he doesn't. He just stands in between two bits of fire, raises his arms up, and still not on fire.
Still not on fire. Not ever on fire.
Nope, not on fire. Nope, not on fire.
And Baldur's just like, well, let's head out. Well. Let's do our quest. So the next suggestion
was that...
He will
do literally anything to get out of parenting these two. He's like, I'm just going to set myself on fire. I don't know. I'd rather just...
He has spent a grand total of 10 minutes with the two, from babies to their 20-year-old selves. Yeah. But the next location that Corman suggested was Portugal, and that is how it was reported in May of 1982. In press of Atlantic City reported that New World was shooting a movie called The Barbarian in Portugal. That was the original title of the movie, The Barbarian, which does make some sense. And certainly more sense than Sorceress. But of course, Sorceress was the title that Corman did his usual rigorous testing methods with around high schools. And that was the title they came up with. We'll see if we can find a sorceress. I don't think there is one, but we'll see what we can do. Jack then did go to Portugal, and there was no industry set up there. No one really spoke English, so they decided against it. And while Jack was in Portugal, he got a kidney stone. And lying in bed in pain, Corman called him and said, oh, you should head to Italy. So here's what Jack told Callum. He said, I thought, this is fantastic. We can shoot in Tunisia. The Italians are really set up there, and that would be ideal for the story. So we went to Rome. The producer really loved the script, and they wanted to start breaking it down and everything, and they were really excited about it. Then about 2 weeks later, I got another call from Roger, and he said, get on the next plane to Mexico. I have a better deal from there. So I thought, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? But it was too late to turn back. And it's too late for these girls to turn back from heading into town, which they've apparently never been, because they are the two most gullible people on the planet.
They're also following two people who refused to engage in a battle. So it's the blind leading the blind right now.
Yeah. And I guess they're learning a little bit about how justice is met out in town. This is a scene that's like doesn't really ever come back. It's something we need to know for the movie, but it's here. It's nice. You know, it's a nice effect.
Also, are we supposed to believe that those hats are the difference makers and them being discovered to be women
right,
or men?
Right. They look totally like boys with those hats on.
Bucket hats always, you can't tell. Once somebody has a bucket hat on, you're like, is it an adult? Is it a child?
Well, Baldur
is
unaware. Baldur is unaware until they take their clothes off. So, fooled him. So, we are going to eventually...
Well, he's also hanging around with Pando. So, he's got a lot of other issues. Pando, spoiler alert, is a completely useless character. I mean, he must be cool to hang out with. He obviously can play the pan flute. But he does nothing to help anyone at any point in this movie.
Yeah.
And here we're at the Cirque du Soleil Training Academy.
Also a perfect place to air out your rugs, your small area rugs. Just put them outside. You can hang them up.
They can get a stink.
And, you know, the ladies of the day and the ladies of the night will make sure that the rugs are aerated. There you go. Just put them there next to our open fires and our clay pots.
You don't have modern plumbing. You really do need to air out those. Those things will get a stink. This is where we meet Prince Erlich, who is played by Roberto Nelson, credited here as Bob Nelson. And he is cheating, and he's going to get caught for this later for cheating. But it's the two girls watching when walking into this area. Why are you even taking them here? What would be the point? I guess he's trying to get Erlich, but there's no reason for these two to be in this area.
Yeah, maybe they had a rug to drop off. You never know. You never know.
Or they had gone to Vegas.
Ah,
oh,
double snakes.
And like, hey,
what a necklace.
I feel like I can do that.
Can take a moment for Mustache's necklace there. Fantastic.
This was during the time when having a big, poofy man fro was hot.
Yeah, was acceptable.
Was hot,
really.
I mean,
was getting a
greatest
perm.
American hero.
Uh-oh, look at that guy's hat. What, that. Is it a guy that, or is it a young woman? I guess we'll never know. I don't know.
He's got that hat. It's impossible to tell. William Catt, of course, you say from Greatest American Hero, also from New World's House. I mean, where that sweater game, oh my lord, unrivaled, that sweater game.
Incredible. Some of the best sweaters ever in cinema.
And Jack had a lot of issues shooting this movie in Mexico. There was a lot of issues. The crew, he said, which were very good. The Mexican crews, they were very hardworking and they knew what they were doing. But they had just problems. In fact, the crew said told Jack that the production had the most problems of any movie they had ever been on. Including, he tells a story a lot that that at one point Dino De Laurentiis came to shoot Dune. As a big, 1984 is the David Lynch Dune, and that they were shooting on the they basically took over the whole studio and took all their lights and everything that they were going to use for that day and took it over, and so they couldn't shoot. He tells that story quite often, but I would, looking into it, I was like, I think Dune came out later. And so I looked it up. I mean, as far as I can tell, Dune did not start shooting until 1983, which is well after Sorceress had been released. So I don't know what Dino De Laurentiis was doing in Mexico and what he was shooting, but I'm not saying he he didn't do what he did, but I don't know if he was shooting Dune. Maybe he was shooting some test shots? I don't know, because they didn't start shooting yet, so I don't know.
Watch out, this maybe man or woman in a bucket hat and a sliced up shirt is coming after me. Watch out. Got some strong kicks. Seriously, his kicks are taking me.
It wasn't Dino De Laurentiis behind like Conan the Barbarian in some of those movies too?
Yeah.
So
yeah. I mean, was he doing it just to mess with him? I mean, could be.
Potentially.
Got him.
Notice Pando just sitting in the background, not engaging.
Mm-hmm. Worthless.
He's just an observer. He's just here to take notes. Do you have the minutes for that fight, Pando? Yep, got him. Good.
And here's where I'm also confused. Is Roberto Nelson's playing Erlich, is he the barbarian of the film? I have to say that he is, right? They refer to him as such. But I'm like, so what's Baldar?
I think they're both barbarians.
Right.
They both are. There's
Well, they definitely aren't our sorceresses. That's what we know for sure.
Do you guys think that's a wig?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, okay.
You mean on Pando?
Pando is really like useless. The fact that they keep him around is what makes this movie, I think, why we love it. But it's he's so impractical to have around.
He's a friend with a pool. That's where everybody keeps him around. In the summertime, like, let's go to Pando's. Yeah. He's annoying. He doesn't do anything. I know, but he's that really sweet pool. Come on. He always has the good snacks.
He doesn't say anything. He just baws like a sheep.
I know, but man, that pool is dope.
You get used to it.
Yeah.
The pool's really nice.
Yeah, just throw him some apples if he's annoying you.
His mom's always got an igloo full of Capri Suns that you can tap into.
The rugs are perfectly aired out. Let's just go. Great. Come on.
I guess Pando's.
She's
meant
so
to be
well
the
hidden. No one will know
movie.
It's her as her bums just hang out behind these. What a good disguise. No one knows it's her.
Yeah. And she instantly gets these two twins caught. I mean, immediately.
Yeah.
Yep. Just knocks on the door and they get caught. Another issue that Jack said happened is that he said the Mexican film vault on the studio lot blew up. Nobody knows how many people were killed. He said the government hushed it up. However, I believe it was because of all the old nitrate films that were stored there without proper precautions. And that vault were all the...
And also... Dino De Laurentiis happened to be walking around at the time.
He was just lighting a cigar and he threw his match. And the door was wide open. It's, you know, Dino, you ruined so many things.
Oh, Dino.
Why?
You scoundrel.
He said that it blew up all the classic Mexican films from the golden era of the country's filmmaking, too. It also blew out the lab and we lost a day's footage from that. And the authorities hushed it up. Nothing but trouble.
This is when we're first starting to get the do you get the difference between boys and girls conversation?
Yeah, but again, they haven't been told, like, don't run off with some stranger. This woman comes and talks to him and just says, Tragon's here. And they're like, oh, it's Tragon. Well, let's open the door. Like, what are you doing?
Well, they were taught swordsmanship, how to use a bow and arrow, how to ride a horse.
Yeah,
the parents just didn't get to some of the other smaller details, Ryan.
Yeah, hot dad sure didn't. Was gone, taken too soon.
And Gandalf obviously wasn't going to teach them shit.
Also, why did they take their shirts off? There was no reason to just disrobe. It's hot, so I'm just going to take all my clothes off. Oh, boy.
Oh, see? They're hot. There it is. Now we've got a reason.
It's warm in here. That's why you got to take your clothes off. It is an unusual film for Jack to make because he had never made anything on this scale, and so I can see why he thought this might be something that would show a totally different side of him. It's one of the, I think, one of the wilder films in his entire filmography. Sadly, also the last, but it is something that I can see where the allure was of showing what he could do and the kind of movies he could make, not just making Coffee and Foxy Brown and Switchblade Sisters, that he was capable of a lot of other things.
And of course, they go walking out without their bucket hats, so now they're totally exposed.
Yeah, now they're clearly not boys.
Mm-hmm.
But Ryan, to your point, the movie, outside of its somewhat hilarious special effects, is well shot. It looks, you can tell that he was trying to make something bigger than what it ended up being.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, that, of course, the proverbial net that you can never get out of.
Oh, that net.
Thank you,
you bring
buns.
All these men, and yet it's the net.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say the same thing. Thank you, Buns. You are dismissed.
Is he like the hawk of all of these, you know, the guy in charge of all these bird soldiers? Oh, Pando.
See, once again, Pando. Ain't doing shit. What, not helping.
Why wasn't he there to keep the girls from going anywhere? He's doing nothing right now other than walking around town.
He's everywhere and nowhere all at once.
He had to go put acid in the pool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
So, come on by, the water's fine.
I just checked the pH. It's in perfect shape.
There's a moment where he gets a sword. Yeah, and it's supposedly like a different way that they made the sword. I don't know if that particularly pays off, but I imagine that this was... Because the ending gets changed, so I don't know if this was a scene where they just thought, okay, this was going to pay off, and that he would get this particular sword. I'm not sure that that's... This has
the payoff.
Sword
haggle scene,
cut.
With the sword haggle scene, is he the first Karen? Kind of complain about, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know,
maybe.
Like complain about the quality of something, wants a return.
Look, how do they not know Pando's weird sign language yet? Like, that's really not good. If you don't know how to communicate with this guy, then what the hell?
Well, they didn't need to explain it to me. Some of his gestures were pretty obvious what he was talking about.
Classic, like, just keep doing the same thing and they'll just figure it out.
Right.
We are now introducing Princess Delicia into the movie and her very believable pet monkey. Who knew?
I feel bad for these guys up front who are really trying to hold this thing up. You can tell that they are struggling to keep this
There's
thing
like
up.
There's like four guys in the back and two in the front. It's like, this is not...
Mm-hmm.
Delicia is played by Anna de Sade from the Corman-produced I Escaped from Devil's Island and the Charles Bronson movie Cabo Blanco. Hunu is played by Douglas Sandoval, who also played a bartender in New World's In and Out. Apparently, he studied the movements of apes in order to play this character. Because when we look at that face, we're like, that's a real monkey.
Well, the face combined with
had he not gotten the accurate movements, we would have been like, wait a minute, I don't think that. I think that's just a person in a monkey suit. But no, now we know. And he has a whole gang. Where did they all come from? I feel like that was in the longer cut. There is a longer cut of this. The original cut of this movie that Jack submitted was like 2 hours long, a little bit over. Now Jack says he delivered a 100-minute cut. Wynorski says anywhere from 2.5 hours to 2 hours and 15 minutes, which isn't outrageous for like an early rough cut, but which of course they took away from Jack and re-edited. And I think this is interesting logic, like the fire will tell which one is the firstborn. So, but also like, if they got it wrong and they took the wrong one, she would just have a melted face, I guess. So they're like, that's you gotta take some risks.
If it doesn't burn her, then she must be the one. It's the same kind of bullshit trial that was used to determine if the woman was a witch in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, guys, you gotta burn a few eggs to make an omelet.
Is that?
That's the same. It's that classic saying.
Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They shot this movie in Mexico in October 1981. So by the time that they were being reported that it's in Portugal, they really have that kind of wrong. Have not updated their files. They also, all the voices that you're hearing, another point of contention for Jack was the fact that most of the voices were dubbed by people around the office of New World. They were not done by professional dubbing teams. So that was something, and also done without any of Jack's input. So the entire dubbing sessions were nothing that he overlooked or had any part in. So he was pretty upset with that as well. Look at Pando being able to jump on that horse, though.
Mm-hmm. Hop right up on that horse.
Right, but he doesn't bring any weapon. He's just riding a horse.
But arguably, isn't he half horse? Why can't he just run off?
Isn't he like half goat?
Like just mount himself?
Oh, he's half goat? Oh, all right.
Isn't that what the bottom half is? I mean, that's why he...
Yeah, I think it's
makes goat. That sound. It sounds like a sheep to me, but I guess it's a goat sound.
Could you argue she's the sorceress?
Sort of. I mean, I think we...
She has magical powers, right?
She's able to, I think as you said in our episode, she's able to fling some gunpowder and into some flames and make it spark. I don't know. She's the closest we get. Unfortunately, she's somebody because she's Tragon's, like, not his girlfriend, but like his pal. Like somebody who's working with him. And as we get into the movie, she starts.
This is Mexico right here. Oh, it's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. Now we're back into a studio, but yeah, that was Mexico.
That's neat. That's really.
She is like Tragon's buddy or co-conspirator. She seems really into later in the movie. She seems really into Ehrlich, but then she doesn't ever make a move on him. And when she thinks that she might, then Tragon comes in and she's like, "Oh no, I'm just tricking him to do whatever I want." And I'm like, "Okay." So and she never ever tries again for him. So I'm like, "Okay, well, what are you getting out of this?" He's definitely like, "I can't be with you. Because I got to kill one of my daughters, so sorry."
Also, I think that outfit choice that old is going to be really... That old line. Her outfit choice is going to be really tricky, because wearing gold, little discs or plates like that during the day, they're going to get hot. It's just going to be hot on your chest. And then at night, it's going to cool down, so then it's going to be cold. It just seems really impractical. Just wanted to add that important bit of information.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out that from really now on and through to the end of the movie, she wears a succession of outfits that you can't help but look at and say, that can't be comfortable.
Yeah, you notice she moves very slowly and steadily, and that's got to be because that outfit was very unforgiving.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of pinching, a lot of rubbing and pinching in that outfit. And many outfits to come. Now, they decide that they're all going to hang out by this fire and shoot the shit and talk about the fact that how our baby's made. We get, like, the birds and the bees story here, which distracts them from the giant monkeys in the trees right above them.
I love how the monkeys are just lounging in those trees. They're, like, just, like, chilling out. It's like... Throwing fruit down, which apparently has a laughing gas type effect. Again, they get caught instantly, these girls. They are not good at not being caught. And the fact that they're setting up this camp, they're like, okay, we got to protect these two girls more than anything else. And they get, and a bunch of monkeys take them away. It's like, dear God. And it's so exciting to Pando. Literally one of the creepiest dudes you can have around. You take Ehrlich as well back to the castle. Gets one of them in the butt.
I didn't realize that monkeys, if you shoot them in the butt, they just get angry and run off.
Yeah, like other dudes die from an arrow and he's just like, "Ooh, man, my butt." Oh, that sucks.
It's a real tight hug for a first time greeting.
Yeah.
Everybody's uncomfortable with it, even his henchmen. They're like, hug. He went right in for the hug.
He's got that open chest, too, so you want to get that skin on skin as much as possible with that first hug.
It, as weird as this movie, and it sort of has become a bit forgotten, it was a pretty big success at the time. Of course, Jack had sort of taken his name off of it and sort of disowned it, but the movie actually did very well for New World. It was kind of a surprise. New World's biggest problem with this movie was actually the fact that it was being held over week to week. They thought it would just play in a theater for 1 week and then they could move the prints on, but a lot of places asked for them to hold on to the prints, which meant they had to process more of them to send them around the country, which is not something they were anticipating. So they did not think that this movie was probably going to be a giant success, and yet it did pretty well for them.
The way that you describe that, look at this outfit. How can you lounge in that? How could you go for a walk?
Those weights are like to help you like really work and activate your core. That's what those things do. They really make you. Is that it? You have to stand in such a way that really activates your core. An incredible scene coming up, of course, because they finally caught him for using this dice. And that is illegal, apparently, in this world. You cannot cheat in the games. That is, they weren't even there at the games. Anyway.
No.
Doesn't matter if we participated. We're going to make you pay for it. And, of course, take him outside to put him on a greasy wooden spike. And one of the best scenes.
Greased up pole.
Yeah. And have a spike below him to Pierce's butthole, I guess. Like, what? Would that go through him? Is that the intention? I
don't think piercing the butthole is the issue. I think the butthole doesn't need to be pierced. It's once you get beyond the butthole itself, what are we piercing?
I mean, what if you're...
Do you want me to draw you a map?
What if the pole just goes right up his crack? And it's just kind of fun. Then it's just fun. It's like,
what if he clenches his butt cheeks so tightly that he just stops it, and he just hangs there, just barely on the tip of the stake. He's like, I won't go any farther.
He suddenly changed his tune. He's totally going to do whatever they say because he's on this pool. Again, look at how she's barely moving. Her movements, that clothing's not good.
No, definitely not.
Inching closer to that butt piercer.
What you described, though, about them having to figure out how to make more prints of this movie, New World seemed to have been so used to failure that when a actual hit came their way, they were like, well, what do we do? What do we do with this?
Well, it's also, it was probably good because it comes out at the end of 1982. It starts entering theaters, I think, in September of 1982, and then they start moving it across different territories throughout the U.S. And it ends up becoming the new boss's probably issue because Corman sells the company in 1983 at the top. So the new owners really are the ones probably that are having to get all these prints and move them around. And so they've got a little bit of a success kind of coming in to New World at this point. And of course, this isn't where Corman stops with the sword and sorcery movies. He goes on and makes Deathstalker after this. He makes Warrior and the Sorceress. He makes Deathstalker 2. He makes Barbarian Queen. He makes a bunch of these. And he really sees that he can do... Of course, he makes most of the ones I just mentioned in Argentina, not Mexico. But he really does learn, like, oh, I can make these movies on the cheap, and they do pretty well. So he makes up for not for missing out on Hawk the Slayer and gets a huge amount, makes a huge amount of these kinds of movies.
None of them can compare to this one, though. I mean, between the girl children, Pando, and, you know, some of the awe-inspiring special effects that are waiting at the end.
Waiting towards the end.
This one, Sorceress, is always had a soft spot in my heart. Now here you see the triangle is moving a little further down on what is more of an Aztec type symbol behind them. But eventually they're going to say that the moon is aligned when it's on the eye of one of the characters down below. Either way, it's a very loosey-goosey rule that they're following here as to when the evil will rise and he will take over the world.
It's also weird that the light is so... It's actually perfectly focused. It was perfectly kind of focused where it was, but he's like, yeah, but the real magic will happen when the light's further in this weird other part. So,
mm-hmm.
So it's like completely off.
Right.
It seems like it's right where it's supposed to be, but they're like, no. But it's when it's this other weird part, that's when the magic really starts. That's when it really kicks in.
No, it's down at it's down at like 5 o'clock over the eye of the character at the bottom. That's when it kicks in. Now this is where Elric is going to meet up. Is it which one? Mara? Mira? Which one is the one that's captured right now?
I believe Mara is the one that he ends up with, but first he has to talk to Delicia. Just make sure you get your butt, you know, really oiled down, especially after a day on a slippery pole there.
Well, the front was already slippery, so he had to even it up. Otherwise, you know, his buns would dry out. That desert heat wreaks havoc on those buns.
Now, Roberto Nelson doesn't really do anything else New World related. But, apparently, he did get a little too into whichever twin was playing Mara. Because Jack revealed to the LA Weekly in 1996, he said that his leading man got a little too close to his leading lady and said, quote, they were having this terrific romance. And then he threatened to kill her.
Ooh.
Wait, so is that what happens when you get too close to someone?
I guess the terrific romance, I have to think, turned a bit sour? Because that doesn't sound like that's going well. That would be Lynette Harris, who is playing Mara.
I hope that happened at the end of filming. I mean, not that I hope that happened at all. I'm just saying, if it had to happen, should have happened then.
It is just, I think, yet another terrible part of the production, I believe.
A chain dress now, also seems like a tough outfit. That's a tough nightgown, you know? Hard to fall comfortably asleep in that one, especially with the knife on the chest. It's tough when you're a side sleeper, tummy sleeper. It's kind of a tough outfit. But.
Yeah, you don't want to take that off before you go to sleep, though, because the sleep you get in that is too good.
It's too good? All right, I thought it might be late.
Yeah.
Imagine, you know, when you lay on your pillow on your side and you wake up and you have, like, pillow creases on your face? Imagine the creases that you're going to have from chain negligee.
Lynette and Lee Harris, they don't do anything else after this. They only showed up in Eye of the Jury, and then they get this movie, and I think they might have done one other TV show. They really have no other credits, so much like Jack Hill, I guess they felt like, or maybe unlike Jack Hill, they felt like this movie is all we, that's really all we've done it. We did everything we wanted to do. As artists, they end up actually getting sued in the 90s because they were together with a wealthy widower named David Kritzik, and he gave these women $500,000 each over the course of many years, and then they didn't pay taxes on it. So they were near getting, it got into a lot of trouble because they hadn't paid any unpaid taxes. They appealed, and it did get thrown out because they were said that it was considered gifts, so that they did not have to pay taxes on this stuff. So they got away with that part.
How that would work out.
Yeah. Apparently, Kritzik was the one who had to pay taxes on the money, and
well, even so, yeah, I think you're only allowed $10,000 a year in gifts, but without having to pay tax on it.
Well, they were together for many years, also, so I think it might have been cumulative, but that's still, it'd be like 50 years to try to get yourself to that much.
Right.
It's a long, I'm not sure how that works. I wasn't going to get into the nitty gritty of the lawsuit. I know that that's what everybody comes to commentaries for. They're like, give me the legal goods, but
I think they're probably wondering right now why we're not talking about this scene and the
two
that are one, and when one is having sex, the other one feels it, which is only to the delight of Pando, who can't wait to rub one out.
He looks like he is. He looks like he is below the below the camera lens. Of course, this is where Jack Hill says the movie is based on the Corsican brothers. He said only that they're women, and the Corsican brothers, when one gets whipped, the other feels pain. And this one, the girl's getting laid, and the other one feels what she feels. So that was his inspiration.
I don't know if this will bring an unsexy element to it, but what about what happens when one's going poop? Does the other one feel that as well?
Does the other one feel relieved? The other one's like, oh, I can eat again.
What about diarrhea? What about when it's diarrhea? Is that, and the other one feels that cramping pain? I don't want to bring an unsexy vibe to this scene, but just curious. Just
what happens when one twin gets norovirus? How does that work itself out?
Yeah, does the other feel it?
Also, Baldur is, during that scene, keeps saying, oh, that must be Elric. Yeah. He knows real well that it's Elric. How does he know that well?
He's like one of those really supportive friends who is just like, damn, that's my buddy, man. That's my guy. Like,
it's my guy.
It's my boy, man. He's having sex with women. Like, yeah, that's my guy, man.
He's the goat. So I know you're technically the half goat, Pando, but he's the real goat. He's the full goat. He's the goat. He's goated.
He's the actual goat. You're a half goat.
You are half goated. He is fully goated.
So they are forgetting their origins and the fact that she's going to be murdered, all because they're drinking whatever is in that green lit up cup.
Yeah, again, they were not told to just don't drink stuff when you don't know what it is. You know, they're just like, and they won't like Ehrlich will not stop. He's so into it.
Mm-hmm. He finds it delicious. Yeah, sips. He finds it delicious. Memory Zap Cola, yum yum. Have me have more. I'm just a monkey hanging out, or maybe an ape. I don't know.
What happened to all his buddies? That guy had a lot of friends. I know he's hanging out because he's been promised one of the twins, but, you know.
They're all trending to that one monkey's arrow in the ass, you know? That poor guy.
This section, when we get, I think, to the back end, I think this is what Jack described as the big climactic scene, another backlot shoot. It began to pour down rain, so they had problems shooting this one. Everybody said it was the only time in their lives they had seen it rain at that time of year, so that was the experience.
Hmm.
We're setting up our big finale, which we sort of talked about a little bit earlier. You know, here in this section, I think we're, you know, you learn a lesson coming up here that, you know, when you don't give your horny monkey his sex slave, he will turn on you and he will...
He will surprise you,
yeah,
by turning on you fast.
Yeah, turning on you very quick. He is very punitive.
Very, very quick.
Yeah. I love that he's like, come here and fight me, and he gets shot with an arrow immediately.
And then he proceeds to say, oh, okay, so you're just going to have your boys shoot me with arrows, or do they want to fight like real warriors?
Right.
To which I thought, I you're the one that's ill-prepared.
Yeah,
shooting you with a bow and arrow does not make you any less of a warrior. Just the fact that you only came with yourself and one other person.
Also, like, when does a wizard just like, yeah, I should just fight somebody with my fists? Like, he does. Like, how are you going to win him over on that one? Have your men like put down their bow and arrow and fight me like real dudes. Like, well, he's a wizard. He doesn't care about fighting like real dudes. He fights with magic. He doesn't even fight with, you know, anyway, it's bad logic. So leaps of logic.
Well, it gets worse because as this scene goes on, he seems to forget that he does have wizard magic and he's proceeding just to yell for his warriors to fight this battle for him. When he could just pick up a sword, he could just use his wizard powers, and he doesn't, and just demands everyone else to fight. Which I admire, because that's strong management skills. Know when to delegate, know when to focus on the big picture.
I could do this all myself, in the day-to-day. But what would be the point? What would they learn? What would my boys learn if I just do it all?
Exactly. And I'm not then looking beyond today. I need to be focused on where is this empire going tomorrow. Okay, people?
And by the way, Dragon is played by Roberto Ballesteros, who's a Mexican actor, obviously, but also like still kind of working to this day. At least he's got credits up until like 2022. So
nice.
Still out there making it happen. Whether or not he's always dressed in red, I can't confirm or deny. But...
looks really good in red.
No matter what's happening in your community, there's always time for a drum circle.
Always. Nothing sets the mood quite like a drum circle.
Exactly. So now they're down in the catacombs.
The catacombs, and we're going to slowly get to... these guys coming back to life. We get through a little bit of our zombies into the mix. Again, another...
It takes a surprisingly long time for them to come to life. They spend quite a bit of time down here before that happens.
And another thing that they were never taught how to pull an arrow out of somebody's arm. Which when you do, no blood comes out. You're fine. You just got to remove it. You got to do it quick. Then there's no blood that comes out. And then toss it in the fire. It's an unparalleled movie for Jack to have done something like this. It's such a weird movie. The only scenes I can think of with this kind of ending action was the big sequence that he does at the end of Switchblade Sisters, which is a little bit more action-packed, but and is lacking in half-goat men and men in monkey costumes. So, I mean, if I can levy any criticism towards it, that would be that. Like, really could have used a little bit of that. I mean, imagine in Switchblade Sisters if all of a sudden they had a whole bunch of people in monkey costumes. I'm sorry. How does a film get that's great become even better? There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
And apparently the drink that they were drinking is all highly flammable because they just poured it into the fire.
Yeah.
Oh, but they're delicious. Like, oh my god, well, god, did they just pour that in the fire? Anyway, at least I got my cup. Mara barely drinks any of the radioactive juice at home.
Green eyes. Mm-hmm. You know evil is about to happen when the green eyes show up.
Those are like also optical effects, which I have to think were, those are things that they were doing a whole lot at New World at the lumberyard, having also worked on Escape from New York. And those were a lot of the effects that they would have done. But yes, we do have this lineup of virgins that he has come out, which I'm like, what sacrifice are you planning? Are the virgins getting sacrificed? Is your daughter getting sacrificed? I'm confused. How many people are being sacrificed tonight? It seems like a lot.
Also, it looks like she took her helmet, her gold helmet, and then just wrapped it around her left boobie in that other outfit. I don't know how that's comfortable.
Outfits are amazing. Jack has said that they finished the movie, but they did have a problem, and that was because after all the problems they had, they did go over their deadline by a few days. So they did overrun their schedule, and Roger was pissed. He said that Roger was absolutely freaked about that, and he threatened to send goons down to break my legs and stuff. You just laugh about that kind of stuff. And he said, anyway, the bottom line of it is that Roger had promised to do all these great special effects. However, in the meantime, the drive-in business was going downhill. It was giving way to home video, and Roger was losing a lot of money. I would say we're not quite at home video per se just yet. A couple years before that really, really takes over, but it's starting for sure. But he says that Roger did the bare minimum of special effects, nothing like he had told me to do. For example, and I think this is the scene he's talking about, I had scenes that were set up with a camera locked down so you could just put in a background over the top of the set, the night sky or something. But he didn't do that. So in the finished picture, you are literally looking over the top of a set. I think that's all in this, the castle set that we were just in. Also, talk about a buzzkill. Panda was having the time of his life. He had three women dancing over him, and it was like, then he's like, oh, okay. Oh, I need to go fight. Okay, cool. Like, that's not the Panda I know.
Yeah.
The Panda I know never would have left those three dancing women, but.
Mm-hmm.
Jokes on you, because Panda neither fights nor hangs out with those women. He just shows up with the sheep herders, who by the time they get there, the battle's over. There's
nothing more to do here. Yeah, he's rallying the shepherds to just be there to, you know, they're always the ones that take that party to that next level. Like, once you think it's over, shepherds are always there to be like, let's kick it into gear.
Oh.
Yeah, so here we...
Yeah, I don't understand how many sacrifices need to happen for, in order for this prophecy to come through.
Well, luckily, she remembers, and I don't know if the audience will, but do you guys remember Vital? Do you remember that name that was said very early on in the film and never again?
I did.
You did? Okay, good, yes. Because she's going to say it. And just in time for it to go over this one random spot. If you had said, you got to get the light over a certain part of that whole carved piece, I never would have guessed that was the little part where it needed to be over. Never in a million years would I have guessed that. The little
eyeball?
Piece. Yeah. At the bottom corner? Never. Who carved that thing? Come on. That's crazy.
Do you think that the drum circle guys are paid for this event? Because otherwise I think I'm going to get out of here. I don't need to play drums while this thing falls apart.
Once the walls start falling down, I'm out. I'm grabbing my drum and out. That's the thing about a drum like that is you can just pick up and go. That's the other, I think, section of kind of that we'll be getting into, is that Jack says, I remember we had what was supposed to be a very eerie scene with monks chanting the strange melody, but Roger didn't put anything in there, so you just see monks on the screen with their mouths open. I think that's coming up here in a second. So if you do look and look in the background, you're going to see like monks with their mouths open. But now we finally are getting to these guys in the walls coming alive. Could have happened about 5 minutes ago, but we're getting to it now.
Now notice when she gets grabbed again by one of these zombies, whoever that zombie actor was took full advantage
of grabbing
where to grab her. Mm-hmm.
I can't see this mask. I can barely see. I'm assuming it's a dude.
Well, it does have a bucket hat on, so you don't know. You can't tell. Yeah.
We'll never know.
The monk scene, though, does have some sort of what was in the original cut, anyway. It does have some backing from Wynorski. He talked again in this interview in 1989. He said when the film came back, it was 2.5 hours long and had these religious ballets in it from some ancient Greek Terpsichorean tradition or something. It was really unbelievable. He said, of course, Roger was livid and had it all cut out. So, but I think there's little bits of it with those monks in the background that we'll get to in a second. Wynorski said that there was lots of ballets throughout the scene, throughout the movie. There's like little dancing sections, and the first time it happened, Roger was okay with it, and as it continued on, Roger was like, "What is this? What's going on here?" Because Jack is very, has been very upset about the amount that Roger cut down, cuts it down to what is about 77 minutes or so. And
here's your grab bag.
Yep. I couldn't even see this.
This mask.
I'm blind.
I thought they were elbows.
Oh, yeah. I was grabbing your arm. That was.
So here we go. Vital. Huh?
This was, of course, done after Mexico. And again, without Jack's input. Giancarlo Beekler, who had done effects for Forbidden World and other New World projects. He does a little bit of work actually even in Love Letters. So as they're cutting this film down, they're also needing to amp up the Vital, and there he is. And oh my gosh, he told Robert Schuletter about the effects in Sorceress. Carl Beekler said, I created some pretty nice effects, including a large bat-lion-centaur creature battling a disembodied woman's head, breathing fire and spitting. We're going to get to that. Also amazing. I think the general opinion at New World Pictures was that I had a lot to do with saving the film, he says. Oh, boy.
What you're saying is he thinks that the scene we're about to see saved the film?
Well, I mean, they did need an effect, to be fair to him. They did need an effect. So, I mean, that's what they were getting. And they did cut the film down. They cut it down to, as Jack says, down to 72 minutes. It's actually 77. But he said he cut it down so much that Hemdale could not release it as a feature. So Roger sort of double-crossed them by cutting it down to such a low amount. And he also said that at that point, he made no money out of this deal. In fact, despite it being a huge success for Corman, he did not make anything out of it. Hemdale would make their money back, though. They put down their cost as $500,000, even though they didn't actually put any money into this. They just set up the deal for it to be shot in Mexico, but they made their money back. So for those of you worrying about Hemdale. That said, Jack was supposed to get a cut of Hemdale, but they went down as a company. They fell apart, so he didn't get a lot of money at any of that. And
so this is an old-fashioned face standoff. Just two faces staring at each other. Who can give the angriest look?
I love that there's this creature in the sky, and also it's fighting a disembodied head. Like, what are we doing? What is this?
Also, not very far away from each other.
Right. But again, very far away from them. I think, as Jack was saying, he wanted to have this, like, just, it could have been over these sets, and the whole thing could have played, but he obviously was waiting for them to do that effect later. I can't imagine he ever thought it would be exactly what it turned out to be. And he doesn't have a lot of great things to say about the effects. He just was pretty upset about it. I mean, how could you not love that? That's amazing. So here's the monks in the background I think maybe is what he's talking about. And maybe they cut out that whole sequence. But I think that might have been a little bit of a taste of that. And here come the creatures out of the catacombs. I think some of that stuff with the creatures coming out might have been stuff they shot back in the States. I know they shot a little section of it. So this is breathing fire. It's a laser beam.
Breathing green laser
beam. Green laser beam that set things on fire. So, as I said, this is the last movie that Jack would make. And he admitted he quit the business. He told the Houston Chronicle, he said, "I got disgusted by the business. I got tired of being stereotyped. I couldn't direct any serious scripts." So he and his wife, Elka, they left the business. And I know they went to India for a time. They went and studied meditation and yoga. And they sort of went down a spiritual path. But interest in Jack and his career was revived in the mid to late 90s when Quentin Tarantino re-released Switchblade Sisters to theaters and home video via his Rolling Thunder company. And this actually was something that was pretty big for Jack. In fact, he said, "Suddenly I was being considered this legendary cult director. I had never been taken serious, and now this."
What I think is interesting about all of this, so they start playing up what's happening in the sky, and nobody on the ground is paying attention to this. It's a battle that's happening somewhere in the sky. Like, no one even looks up to say, "Well, that's weird, what's happening."
Yeah. Right. They're not reacting to it at all. Again,
do you see what's up there? Or is that happening somewhere else? It's funny. It's just very disconnected. You can tell that they added that later.
Yeah.
And they had no shots of people looking up and saying, seeing what it is.
Let in the shepherds. They'll fix it all. Yeah, I mean, it's all supposed to be over the castle. You're supposed to see it. So it's supposed to be in, you know, it would have made it more seemingly and in line with everything that's happening. Instead, it's happening on its own special section of the starry map sky, so that's why I think it's...
Which you could even accept that it happened above the castle if someone just looked up and pointed it out.
Right. Like, they don't have that. Right, but they never... Because he didn't intend for that to ever be that way. Sadly, the attention that Jack got in the 90s, it did not yield another opportunity for Jack to direct another movie. And so no project came to be. He did mention at the time in the 90s, there was a lot of interviews with him and Quentin Tarantino, and he did mention other scripts that he was interested in making. I think when we talked to Callum in our first episode of this series, he mentioned that it was like a lot of his scripts were like, you know, Jack Hill scripts from the 70s, and it just, that wasn't what Callum said, was that wasn't really the kind of movies that people were making anymore. I'm not directly quoting him, so hopefully I'm not murdering what he was saying, but I think that there was a little bit of that. But it is unfortunate that he didn't get any opportunity at all, even maybe to direct TV. Maybe he wasn't interested in that, but... Oh, you thought that was a sword. It's a snake, buddy. Speaking of snakes, remember? He was cheating games with snakes.
Mm-hmm.
Here's his incredible sword that he got.
It's just a world of illusion.
Ow.
Oh, but one arrow.
Two arrows,
pardon me.
From his daughters, killed by his own loins.
The irony. Ugh. Remember when Baldar got shot with an arrow and he was just like, ugh, this thing in my arm. Can you just whip it out and then I can fight all these dudes? Mm-hmm. Not the same when you get them up in that upper back area between the shoulder blades.
Right, that's the difference between a barbarian and a wizard or a sorcerer. Or sorcerer.
If this is D&D, Baldar's the barbarian, right? Like,
yes.
Like,
yeah.
Erlik is like a thief.
He's a thief with high charisma. High charisma, low dexterity.
I don't think that this was a moment here at the end that could have been anyone else but Jack, and that's just Erlik coming out with two women and being like, look at me, I got two ladies. It just feels like a Jack ending. But anyway, that is it. That is our commentary for Sorceress, one of our favorite movies around here. And thank you for listening to this. Thank you for listening to it. Hopefully you'll go back if you haven't heard our other episodes in this Corman Graduates Jack Hill series. We have other episodes as we go through his entire filmography. We also did an episode on this movie, so you can go back and listen to all those episodes at our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where you can find all of that. And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description